Ben, the floor is yours.
Excellent. Thank you, Harley. Welcome, everyone. I think I recognize maybe two-thirds of the names that I heard. So those of you who haven't met, staying on the cover page, I'll introduce myself. I am the Deputy Program Manager of the newly established Satellite Servicing Projects Division. We happen to be located at Goddard. We are the Satellite Servicing Division, and I will get into what we do and how we do business. And if you looked ahead at the charts, you'll see I've got a couple of those in there. And then I'll tell you in particular about one mission we're working on, and then broaden the topic back out to the larger scope of future in-space operations, which I would assert is going to include more missions and more architectures involving satellite servicing, as we, the global space community, moves forward into space 2.0, and fewer one and done missions, which have served globally us well in the past, but I don't think we need to limit ourselves to that as much as we worldly have over the last five decades. And somebody has a hot mic. All right, so moving on. Oh, well, staying on the cover page. I think it's apropos. We're going to talk a lot about refueling in this presentation. That on the cover page, you see the first American woman to ever have a spacewalk, and that's Kathy Sullivan there in the bottom left corner with Frank Cepolina. And what is she holding? But a robotic refueling tool, a engineering model of what we have presently up on Space Station. The reason why that is so apropos is because the EVA she conducted with Shuttle back in 84 for a young program manager named Bill Gerstenmaier was the orbital refueling system. So back in 84, NASA was devoting resources to tackle the problem of how spacecraft could be refueled. And here we are in 2016, 2017 now, talking about doing it robotically. So that's kind of an interesting photo there, bringing the past up to the present. All right. So this package, page two, this package is designed for a general audience. So most of you are going to be very familiar with the images you see on page two. This is simply to remind folks or educate them if they're a lay audience, that in the last 43 years, we've come a tremendous way from Ed Hoot Gibson performing that parasol repair on Skylab to the construction of the largest, most complex engineering feat mankind's ever undertaken, the International Space Station, and the most scientifically productive apparatus mankind has ever produced, and that is the Hubble Space Telescope. So we've come quite a ways in 43 years in the ability to perform work in space, and what I'm going to present here is the progression of that and then postulate about the future. So chart three, what do we mean by servicing? Let's make sure that when I say servicing, you all know what capabilities I'm encompassing with that. Mission in life here at SSPD is to develop capabilities for resilient architectures. Sometimes that means individual satellites. Sometimes it means fleets of satellites or constellations of satellites. And we talk about them in order of complexity, I would assert, remote inspection being the easiest, just getting up close, personal, and inspecting something without contact. Once you've made contact, the simplest thing to do is to relocate that object, whether that's an inclination move, changing their orbit in another way, or into the drink or up to the graveyard based on where you are. The next in line would be, usually, I apologize, repair normally comes next. Simple repair, snipping a wire, helping a deployment anomaly of nudging a solar array or radiator or antenna to a fully deployed position from a stuck position. And then component, I think the reason why I did them in this order is on Hubble. On the Hubble missions, we did those top four. We did remote inspection, relocation, repair, and replace. And then in the future, we are developing technologies for refueling, replenishing other consumables like cryo, helium, xenon, as well as chemical propellant. And then finally, on-orbit assemblies. That's why I broke it down here. Normally, I do them in order of complexity. I'm just apologize for remembering how my thought process when I built this package. So that's what we're working on here at SSPD. Page four, just showing how we align with the National Space Policy of 2010. I'm not going to go through that in detail. Feel free to read it, but I've highlighted the bolding was done by our group. That's not how it's written in the space policy, just to show you how we align. So page five, what I spend my time doing is going out and having discussions with the folks in that upper ellipse. Right. NASA SMD is in the center left. HEO is in the center right. That's we at SSPD spend the majority of our time discussing what are their future needs, what are their present day needs, commercial owner operators, insurance industry. Yes, does somebody have a question? Okay. Satellite manufacturing industry. Are there space-faring sections of the U.S. government, USGS, NOAA, Air Force, and other government agencies. So we talk with these folks on a continuous basis to understand their specific individual satellite needs as well as their larger architecture needs. You know, what capabilities would make them more resilient moving into the future? Being able to replenish, being able to do instrument or payload upgrades, the ability to assemble something which could otherwise not launch, those sorts of things. We bring those needs into, and now you can see, we used to be called SSCO. This chart needs to have that fixed, so we are now PD, not CO in the middle there. We bring it into the office. And then we figure out what is the best way to build a technology demonstrator or free-flying mission or a ground development effort that stays on the ground. What are the individual technologies within that project? So what you see here is I've highlighted the Raven project, which is scheduled to launch in the first or second or third week of February, whenever we get resupply flights going to space station from SpaceX. We are in the very next launch as one of the three unpressurized payloads in the trunk. And Raven will be advancing technologies for relative navigation as well as the supporting avionics to do it. So Raven will have or does have visible infrared and flash LiDAR that will be used to autonomously track, passively, but autonomously track all of the visiting vehicles coming and going to space station for the 2 years that Raven is attached to ELC-1. So it will be using the three wavelength sensors, visible, infrared, and LiDAR, to get both range and bearing, as well as it will be computing on orbit with on orbit processing, 6 degree of freedom pose estimation of all those visiting vehicles. It will be feed that into an extended Kalman filter, produce a nav solution, and then feed that to the two axis gimbal continue to keep it in the center of the field of view as the vehicles approach and depart space station. So we do that because autonomous rendezvous is an essential element in future satellite servicing. All those R's back on page three, inspection, relocation, repair, replace, refuel, replenish, assemble. First, you need to bring two vehicles together before you can do any of that stuff. And how are you going to bring them together without a human in the loop? If we're operating environments where we don't have astronauts locally to the rendezvous, well, you're going to need an autonomous system. The Raven is a project that we are working on to advance those technologies. We just happen to be using Space Station as a platform to do it. So following the right-hand dotted arrow, now we take those technologies and the capabilities that they provide, and we infuse them back up to our stakeholders. So we have this continuous loop of assessing their needs, developing a project, advancing the technologies, and infusing them back up. So Raven is one of many, and if you change to page six now, projects that we've got going on. So you see the project line there in the middle. The technologies we are working on, essentially all fall within five categories. And you can see them there. RELNAV, the avionics to support it, robotic system and the software to control it, and the avionics that it requires. Advanced tools to go at the end of the robotic arm and the avionics they require, and then a fluid transfer system. And I used a generic term, fluid, there. We are working on, as I mentioned earlier, chemical propulsion, cryogenic fluids, helium, and xenon. And some have common technologies to get them to transfer on orbit, and some have special or unique technologies to get them to transfer on orbit. Bottom of the yes.
Yeah, when you say cryogenic, are you including hydrogen?
We have not tackled that yet, and only because not that particular one, but and only because hydrogen cryocoolers are, assuming we're all adults on this, damn expensive. So we are going for the warmer cryogens first before we tackle the colder ones. So that is on our horizon, but not in our present job jar.
Yeah, but you know ULA is working that themselves for ACES.
For robots to transfer it in orbit?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, ACES is refuelable, and it's a cryo stage.
Okay, well, is refuelable and working on the technologies to actually do it today, I would humbly suggest are two slightly different points.
Okay.
So I'd love to talk with anybody there who's working on the ability to move cryogen around in orbit bubble free. We are flying a payload to space station in 14 months or so, called RRM-3, and inside RRM-3, we are going to be carrying 50 liters of liquid methane. So we have hardware in the lab now that will be used to transfer bubble-free liquid cryogen in a zero-G environment. So if they've got similar technology, I'd be extremely excited to chat with them to see what they've got going on.
Well, we should probably talk to Frank Zegler there.
All right. We can take this offline. How about that? Okay. Moving on to page seven. So the RESTORE mission is what I'm going to focus on for the next few charts. It is our largest project that we've got inside SSPD presently. And I've highlighted all five of the core technology areas inside the technology box there, because RESTORE advances all of them. So what is RESTORE? Moving on to page eight. RESTORE is a technology demonstration mission that is managed out of STMD, Space Technology Mission Directorate at NASA headquarters. The mission will demonstrate a national satellite servicing capability or capabilities. It is advancing essential technologies for NASA and other national goals. And we are designing it and its associated technology transfer plan to kickstart a new U.S. commercial servicing industry with a keen focus on a level playing field so that we get the technology to as many U.S. entities as possible so that we have a robust, healthy, competitive U.S. commercial servicing industry afterwards. And I could talk for hours just on that technology transfer plan. There is a draft or an early rev of what that technology transfer plan that's on the street right now. It's on, if you go to FedBizOps and search it, it's there. We will be holding industry days over the next 3 or 4 years as we prepare Restore to launch, where we will be bringing industry along as we develop Restore. We will be transferring our ConOps, our requirements, our technologies to industry as we develop it for the Restore mission. So if anybody wants to follow with me afterwards on that, I'd be happy to chat with them. But it's not just about doing it for NASA and U.S. government's needs. It's about transferring it to U.S. industry. Okay, so what is Restore going to do? Chart 9. We are going to conduct an autonomous rendezvous, supervised autonomy, so we will be observing and following along with our hand on the abort button, but it will be an autonomous rendezvous, no human in the loop controlling the spacecraft bus for our servicer. We will then get up close, match rates, and do an autonomous grasp. Again, no human in the loop other than to supervise what's happening on board Landsat 7, our client. So we, at that point, we will have, during the autonomous grasp phase, we will have two autonomous systems running in parallel, simultaneously. One autonomous system for the bus matching rates, and the other for the 7 degree of freedom robotic arm reaching out to grab the Marmon ring. As you all have, could probably imagine, Landsat 7 having been launched 19 years ago, memory serves, or 17 years ago, pardon me, was not designed to be serviced. It does not have fiducials, does not have a robotic grapple point. It does not have any Velcro or finger loops, tether loops. So we are building our technologies to be able to accommodate a legacy satellite, a legacy client like Landsat 7. Which is different than the majority of tasks that we performed with astronauts on Hubble, where they were cooperative tasks, right? Instruments designed to be pulled in and out. Certainly, we, in the later missions, started removing covers and digging into instruments where that was not designed to be done on orbit. But I think you could argue the majority of what we did with Hubble was cooperative. And then finally,
Ben, this is Harley. Quick for some of the folks in the audience, what is the Marmon ring?
Ah, thank you. The Marmon ring is the launch vehicle interface. So not every satellite has a ring on its aft end, but the majority do. So at some point, Landsat 7 was sitting in Vandenberg with a rocket underneath it, and the Marmon ring is the launch vehicle interface. So it is essential when it's on the pad and when it's being pushed to orbit, but as soon as it's released from its upper stage, the Marmon ring for the vast majority of satellites now is no longer needed for anything. We like it because it's a piece of structure. It's a piece of hard chassis that doesn't have blankets covering it in most cases. I know that Boeing does have some satellites that with a blanket that covers a Marmon ring, but the majority of satellites, there isn't a blanket covering it, and so it ends up being a convenient mechanical location for our robotic arm to reach up and grasp so that we can subsequently berth our client to our servicer, like you see in that third image on page 9, where we will then use our operations center here at GATA to teleoperate our robotic arms to refuel Landsat 7. Cut wires, cut tape, cut blanket, unscrew caps, and provide hydrazine to Landsat 7. So that will be tele operated, whereas the first two phases are autonomous. So page 10, as I said a moment ago, our client is USGS's Landsat 7. And as a reminder, this is a technology demonstration mission. Landsat 7, this is not a Landsat 7 rescue mission. It turns out that when we are ready to launch happens to very nicely coincide with when Landsat 7 will be decommissioned as a science observatory. So the sequence of events is they go through a decommissioning phase. They are no longer collecting science. They move themselves out of the 705 constellation, 705 kilometers, LEO polar. We would subsequently request permission to approach on the open loops, hopefully establishing, you know, global precedence for how these things are done. We then would execute the steps that I had on page 9 for the rendezvous, grapple, and then telerobotic refueling. A little bit about the programmatics. The servicing payload is a NASA affair where the majority of work is being done here at Goddard, but we do have significant portions that are being done at Kennedy Space Center, our colleagues there, and then a little bit of help from folks at other NASA centers, JSC, Glenn, and JPL. And then our spacecraft bus, when I wrote this chart, we had not yet made an award, but since then we have made an award, so I can tell you that our vendor-supplied spacecraft bus is Space Systems Loral out of Palo Alto, California. So moving on to chart 11, this is a repeat of those five technology areas that you saw earlier with one additional one, the cooperative servicing aids. So this is the technology portfolio that we are making available to interested domestic entities who wish to use these for commercial servicing, with a little bit of detail on some of the subsystems within those larger systems that are part of the portfolio that will be made available. Okay, chart 12. So in between the last Hubble servicing mission, which took place in 2009, and today we have been advancing the technologies for those five key areas. Rendezvous and ProxOps, or the relative navigation system, the Dextrous robotics, servicing avionics, the robotic tools, and fluid transfer. And what you see on this chart is a summary of some of the high-level milestone tests or achievements or demonstrations with each one. And where you see a green triangle pointing down, that is where we did a ground test. Green to make you think of our verdant Earth. Where you see an airplane, that's where we did a zero-G flight. Of course, the space station icon is where we advance our technologies up on ISS, where you see a vertical gray bar connecting across technology rows. That's where we had a multi-subsystem test come together. For example, if you look at Roxit, so in 2014, we had a test where we had a industrial robot located at Kennedy in the payload hazardous processing facility, connected to a fluid transfer system that had several hundred kilograms of oxidizer in it. We had the robotic tools that we're able to interface with a legacy, that is to say, non-cooperative oxidizer fuel valve, and we kept our controllers for that test here at Goddard. So we remotely controlled from Goddard a robotic system at Kennedy pumping hazardous oxidizer into a legacy interface, and we practiced different pressures, different flow rates, different flow technologies, different flow meter technologies. So this was a system level test with multiple subsystems being involved. So I'm not going to go through each one of these tests in any detail unless somebody has a question. But just to give you an idea of some of the work that's been happening with our outfit here in between 2009 and today. Cert 13. So here we're bringing it back up to the high level. We got into the weeds a little bit on chart 12. Now we try to raise it back up to the high level. What is the RestoreL mission context? So that upper set of technologies in blue, those are technologies that are being advanced by the Restore mission. They will lead to the blue capabilities in the center column, which will help enable the missions that have blue outlines in the last column. I've talked about commercial servicing. We are working on the asteroid retrieval mission, which I will talk about in a couple of charts, as well as the ability for the U.S. fleet to be refueled. The United States government is the largest owner-operator in the world. In addition, other SSPD projects at the bottom of the page there, the cryo, the xenon, cooperative servicing, lead to additional capabilities which help enable additional missions, additional architectures. So that's what is kind of an overview of Restore's mission context, but also how does it fold into the larger SSPD role. Page 14. Here is another way to look at what is on page 13, only in a decomposed fashion based on technical complexity of the capabilities we're working on as a function of market size. So we could argue for hours about the replacement and the size of each one of these. For example, cooperative replacement. Today, there's only two satellites that I know of that have payloads and ORUs that were designed for cooperative replacement on orbit, ISS and Hubble. So the market size today is relatively low, 2 out of 1,300 operational satellites. But in the future, I anticipate that market size growing as the advent of robotic servicers grows. The technical complexity is low because it's cooperative. So by design, it should not be technically complex to do it in orbit. Let's talk about repair. So repair I drew as a long ellipse there because some repair jobs might be easy, you know. If you just give me a little tug on my solar array, it can overcome, you know, some torque hump, and it'll deploy properly, as opposed to, you know, a complex repair where non-captive fasteners are being removed and printed circuit boards are being swapped out. So that's why it's a range of things. But you can see the Restore family of capabilities we specifically went after because of the relatively large market size and low technical complexity. So you can see why we chose what we did for this first free-flying mission to relocate, inspect, and refuel a satellite. There's a whole bunch of folks who are potential candidates for those capabilities or those services. And while we are not repairing anything on RestoreL, we will have a suite of tools which could do a simple repair. So I wanted to just nibble at the corner of that to show that we will be advancing some of that technology, although repair is not part of the baseline mission. Okay, chart 15. So just some photographs of some of the hardware we have. In particular, on the right-hand side, that is a view of our prime lab at Goddard, where we do a lot of this work. It is a hardware development lab. It's a robotics procedure development lab. It's a on-orbit simulator lab. We have blacked out walls so we can go fully black to simulate orbit night for teleop work during eclipse. We also have industrial robots which simulate 6 degree of freedom contact dynamics in this lab. So it is also our robotic version of an NBL facility. And what you see in that image is a picture of Landsat, full-scale mock-up of Landsat 7. So in addition, what we have in this lab is an ARM mock-up, and actually maybe I'll do charts 17 and 16 in reverse order. So if you look at page 17 now, what you saw in that image on page 15 was the Landsat 7 mock-up, which is on the left-hand side of the lower image. In the center of that lab, at bottom center of the page, is a styrofoam, 3 meter, no, pardon me, yeah, 3 meter by 4 meter by 5 meter styrofoam mock-up of an asteroid with the capture module underneath it, hidden in view in this image. And then in the on the far right of that bottom image is that contact dynamics facility that I mentioned. We also have two other robotic facilities as part of our facilities within SSPD, one at Goddard in the upper left-hand corner where we do the majority of our ISS work, as well as a large room at a West Virginia Robotic Technology Center, which is an adjunct facility to our work here. And you can see the mock-up of a geo aft end in the West Virginia lab and in our Robotics Operations Center. Those are actually two mock-ups that were built to the same flight drawings, not the same mock-up that got moved. So this is where we do a lot of our development work in these labs, and many of you, doing a mental recall of who's online, have seen these. And if you haven't and would like to, drop me a line, and I'm sure we can make it happen. Going back to page 16, we are working on the asteroid mission, and in particular, if you look at, and this is an old set of mission sequence, so I'm sure that I think there are newer ones online now. But if you look at the image number 3, our responsibility here at SSPD is the capture module, which is the robotic front end of the ARRV. And we have partners with Langley Research Center and with JPL for elements within, but the majority of the hardware for that front end, the relative nav system, the servicing avionics, the robotic arms, the tools, other than the tool that grabs the asteroid to pull it off of the boulder, and the situational awareness cameras, are all, as well as the structure itself, are all the within our responsibility here at SSPD. And the reason why is because they are very common synergy elements to the RESTORE front end. The robotic arms are the same. The payload computer to drive those arms is the same. The navigation sensor suite is nearly the same. asteroids aren't very warm, and so we may not take an IR camera. But other than that, the cameras and the LIDARs are the same, if not very similar. And so as we build hardware for Restore, we are building up the MGSE, EGSE, technical experience, et cetera, for the ARM hardware. So the two missions dovetail together. Okay. Moving on to chart 18. A note about cooperative servicing. So we spend the majority of our time presently with legacy clients, whether they're a several billion-year-old asteroid or a 19-year-old human-made satellite. But we are working on future satellites to make them more cooperative for future servicing. In the upper right-hand corner, you see a rendezvous decal, that black and white square there. I just pulled a little snippet out of the assembly procedure we developed for putting rendezvous decals on MMS. So not the MMS of the 80s, but the MMS that launched 5 years ago now, I believe, 4 years ago. Constellation of four satellites that Goddard launched to measure the magnetopause. Each one of those four satellites that are in orbit now in highly elliptical orbit measuring our magnetopause have rendezvous decals on them. That doesn't mean NASA is planning a refueling mission to those birds, but because it is so easy, such low-hanging fruit to add a decal the size of your badge is hanging on everyone's chest right now to the back of an existing satellite, we decided to go ahead and put those rendezvous decals on. Should anyone decide to go service those birds, it would be that much easier because they would now have a nice high contrast known location from their Marmon ring fiducial. Of course, in the future, with the satellites that are going to be designed closer to the beginning of the project, not 6 months before launch, can start considering servicing. The items like these decals would be baked into the design, as it were. The other item we're working on in earnest, or the next lowest hanging fruit besides the rendezvous decal, is a cooperative servicing valve. That's what you see there in the bottom left in CAD, and then in the center bottom in a photograph of an RP in the lab. So one of the trickiest things about refueling a legacy satellite is threading on to the fuel drain valve. You need very good alignment to do that. And while humans are very good at aligning objects when they thread them together, it's rather tricky for robots to do that, especially short, stiff robots. And so while we are able to do it, and we will be doing it on Landsat 7, it's one of the trickier parts of the job. So we wanted to design a fuel drain valve that could be used to fuel any old satellite at any launch range in the U.S. And if it's adopted internationally, wonderful. But we're focusing on the eastern and western launch ranges first. So we've developed a valve that has triple seals built into the valve, no external lock wire, no external caps, three independent seals all inside, and an interface that has no threading on. It's simply a push interface, a linear actuated interface, linear translation to mate the fueling nozzle with the valve. And so we got a patent about to be issued on this. We are going to be making it available for any satellite that wishes to use it. And it doesn't mean that you will be serviced in orbit, but it means if you are refueled in orbit, it will be that much easier for the robot to interface with the valve.
Ben, this is Harley again. Got a question. This slide number 18 and your description of it brings up a question. You guys, as you've already said, are very approachable for folks who want to know more about this and perhaps adapt this capability or build this capability into their own satellite. Do you all have, or are you developing or building something like a guidebook to make your, you know, satellite servicing for dummies, a guidebook recommendations for how folks might design the various elements, the appearance of the spacecraft, the how various instruments and subsystems might be attached and might be able to be removed, and so on and so forth, so that folks could, without necessarily having to come to see you, could even in early days start designing their spacecraft to be as accessible to you all as possible.
Yeah, excellent question. The reason why I have the bottom right image there, that is the WFIRST observatory that NASA is presently working on for a 2024 launch, I think. Don't hold me to that. It is being designed with servicing in mind. So as we work with the WFIRST project, and we are working with other satellites, we are putting together a list of best practices, a list of servicing assumptions, a guidebook, just as you have said, for what does it take to make a client serviceable. And it will be a range of things. Some people might be interested in refueling only or relocation only. Some people might be interested in payload swap out, whether that's a scientific instrument or some other remote sensing package. So we are, because it spans such a broad range of possibilities, we are working on it. We do not have anything on the street today. I will be giving a talk at Satellite 2017 in March of this year, and my title of my talk is something like, should I design my satellite to be serviceable? I don't know, something catchy like that. Which we'll get into a little bit more of those details. The counterexample that I like to give of a satellite that probably would not have made sense to make serviceable other than modularity on the ground during integration and test oftentimes is reason enough to use some of these design practices, but leaving that aside for the moment, is STEREO. So STEREO, right, is a pair of satellites, one in a drift-away orbit, Earth-trailing, and one Earth-preceding. And so every day they are racing away from Earth at top speed. And so that would be tough to put together an economically feasible servicing mission to go after one of those, much less both of them. So that's a counterexample I like to give of something that probably would not have made sense. Another example of something that doesn't make sense to make serviceable is a phone sat, right? People that are tossing up Androids and iPhones as a short-lived satellites in LLLL LEO, or maybe even CubeSats don't make sense, although maybe that paradigm will change in the future. So because there are so many different types of satellites, it's hard to have one single design guide for all of them, from a flagship like WFIRST down to a CubeSat. But nevertheless, we are putting our best practices on paper for just such a document, Harley. So how's that for our short answer to your question?
No, Ben, this sounds great. Thanks. Please continue.
Okay. Ben, this is Dave Huntsman at Glenn. While you're on this page, the cooperative servicing valve sounds like a really intelligent effort to have done, and more power to you. But it brings up the question, you know, there are several times in NASA's history where we've developed what we NASA internally developed, but we intended to be a generic thing like the old NASA standard transponder that we expected everybody in Earth orbit to use from now on. And then afterwards, the rest of industry just didn't think it was that economic or the right way to go, and it wasn't that popular. How do you know, how is your confidence level that things like the CSV and your own tool set are exactly pretty much what a majority of likely service providers actually will want to use if it's demonstrated that it works.
Yeah. Good question. So my confidence is moderately high, and I don't know what that actually means in terms of numbers, if there is a scale for confidence. But I'll tell you this. Last year we gave, Peter Sui, are you online? Not to put you on the spot, Peter, but how many tours did we give in calendar year 16? Do you have that number by any chance?
It's roughly 250.
So we gave roughly 250 tours last year, albeit some of them were just gee whiz tours, but to people from, you know, lay civilians coming through. But a lot of those tours were to companies that build commercial satellites for a living. Every major satellite manufacturer in the U.S. has been in the lab, and I seek input every time they come. Here's what we're doing. We're qualifying it for both the Eastern and Western launch ranges. We are designing it so that it can interface with standard stainless steel prop tubing with standard bulkhead mount. It is no taller than a standard fill and drain valve, or maybe it's 2 centimeters taller, I think. I can't remember now off the top of my head. So we are trying to make it a drop-in replacement for what's existing. So does that mean anyone will adopt it? I can't postulate that, but I can tell you we are trying to make it as low a hanging fruit as possible, so somebody feels downright silly for not putting it on, especially if they're going to GEO, which is a prime market for somebody to launch a service or two. So I don't know why the NASA standard transponder failed. If I knew why, if there was a lessons learned, you know, what we NASA did wrong back in the day was, I don't know how much of that's applicable to this scenario, but it's a good question, and we're thinking hard about it. I go to a lot of conferences to tell people about these things to try to elicit their feedback. I'll leave it there. I want to try to get to the last page, which is mighty close, but within the time. So page 19 is just to try to bookend this package to say we came an incredible distance from Skylab to ISS in the first 40 years. So what does the next 40 hold? I do not know, but it sure is going to be fun to see. And then my last chart is related back to the title of this chart. So I said servicing evolution. Evolution, we started with humans alone with no robotic assisting them. Ed Hoot Gibson had no robot to assist. In the middle decades, we had the shuttle RMS in conjunction with free-floating astronauts. On Space Station, of course, same thing with SSRMS and Dexter, working in tandem with the EVA crew members. With what we are working on now for LEO Polar, for Landsat 7, and the servicers that go to GEO in the upcoming decade, those are going to be robotic only, simply because humans, we don't have a safe way to get humans there. But eventually, as our technology matures, we're going to get to, I hope, and I am working hard towards, paradigms where we're back to humans and robots working together, doing things that cannot otherwise be done. And my example here is, you know, a very large aperture satellite being built with humans and robots working together. Don't pick apart the details of this picture. It's simply to highlight where we will be going next, I assert. And that's it. Thank you for your attention. I'm happy to entertain any questions.
Great. Thank you, Ben. So folks, do you have questions?
Ben, yeah. This is Jerome Pierce from Star Technology. On slide 13 at the bottom, you had one mission orbital debris mitigation. Can you tell me what you have in mind under that one?
Yeah, great question. Thank you. So on there are different size classes for orbital debris, as everyone here is well aware. This is a very learned audience. You've got your undetectables, things that are 1 inch or smaller. The trackable range is, I think it's 1 inch, you know, and larger. Of those, you can bin them kind of into three bins. Nuts, bolts, washer size, maybe the size of a hubcap, and then things the size of a car. So I'm only going to now refer to things the size of a car. If somebody were to fund an orbital debris removal mission, our technology for autonomous rendezvous, autonomous grasping, and then relocation, I think, are well suited for spent rocket bodies, derelict satellites, things of that size, things of that nature. Of course, if they've got an ultra-high tumble rate, well, then I withdraw my statement. But the low-speed tumblers that are of that size, our technologies that we're developing for Restore, that's why I put a blue box around it, I think are quite applicable. No one that I know of is working on such a mission. We certainly are not. Our technologies happen to be commensurate with that type of mission, although we're not actively pursuing anything like that presently.
Thank you.
Yep.
Okay, Ben, it's Dave. Yeah, Dave Huntsman at NASA, Glenn again. I was going to ask you about the your confidence level on the fidelity of the Landsat 7 mock-up, because you may remember some of our first shuttle satellite servicing missions. We had at least one or two cases when we went up there, and the very connection systems that had worked well on the mock-up, satellite mock-up on the ground, maybe it was Solar Max. We got up there and didn't work, and the drawings that the mock-up had been done to were wrong. So how do you feel about that?
I'm well aware of Solar Max, and Intelsat 6 is the counterexample. Lance, for those of you who are not familiar, Solar Max, a human went out to grapple Solar Max. The coupling failed. The Solar Max began to tumble. The astronaut backed off. And a subsequent day, they used the shuttle RMS, the robotic arm, to grab Solar Max, berth it, and then that mission was concluded successfully. The counterexample is Intelsat 6, where the robotic arm in the shuttle was used to grab Intelsat 603 satellite. It failed. The satellite began to tumble. They floated down overnight, and then the following day, a triple EVA, triple spacewalk, first time ever and only time ever in NASA's history, I believe. The three crew members grabbed Intelsat 6 and berthed it in the payload bay. So in one case, the human saved the robot, and the other one, the robot saved the humans. On our mission to Landsat 7, we don't have a backup. Well, we kind of do. We are going to go in for an autonomous grapple, and the reason why we have spent 4 or 5 years now developing a 6-degree of freedom contact dynamics facility at Goddard, which I mentioned back on page, is so that we can convince ourselves we're not going to bump the satellite and have it tip off and not be able to capture it, just as you have surmised. So we've looked at the lessons learned there. We have people on our team that were part of the DART mission, the Orbital Express mission. We've looked at lessons learned from those two shuttle-based missions. So I can't tell you we're not going to make a mistake, but we are doing our due diligence to learn what they did and try to accommodate that in our system design. Next question.
Okay. Good. Ben, I've got a question. At the distances that you are working between the operator and the robot, you probably don't suffer limitations due to finite light travel time. At some point, that might be a problem. Are you thinking of ways of getting around it, or is it simply not really yet an issue for you all?
Yeah, great question. So the biggest question that comes up at LEO, which is really up to TDRS and back, so it's really GEO times two is when you're doing LEO servicing. GEO, the Earth-Moon Lagrange systems. I think for all of those missions, you're talking less than 4 seconds, and the vast majority of that in all of those cases is computers, usually computers on the ground, but computers on orbit as well, leading to that 1 to 2 to 3, maybe 4. It's when you get out to Sun-Earth L2. That's when the time of flight of the control really starts to become significant. So we have begun looking at that. We have no Sun-Earth L2 missions presently on our books, but regardless, we are looking at that, and we're looking at it because of WFIRST. So I presented a paper at Edinburgh, Scotland this past year talking about what it would take to do a 2-observatory refueling mission at Sun-Earth L2 and where the technology gaps are between here and there. And Teleop Robotics is the major one, and that is where our cooperative servicing valve, a Velcro flap covering the refueling, come into play. If you put fiducials for rendezvous, fiducials for the robot to key on to do an autonomous fueling, then the need for Teleop is greatly diminished. I won't say it goes away, because you always want to have some unplanned task, capability to do an unplanned task, to get out of a jam or whatever the contingency might be. So we are developing some, we're putting some effort into high latency teleop robotics, but it's, I don't know, it's probably less, you know, it's less than 1% of our total budget we've got working on that. But we are looking at it for those Sun-Earth L2 observatories.
Harley?
Yep.
Yeah. Hey, this is Steve Brody at ISU. Ben, just a final word, if you're not, if it's of any value to you, I know that there were 2 ISU research projects about one-orbit servicing taken up in the last decade. One was, the most recent one was in 2014, and characteristic of ISU, it took a look at the interdisciplinary challenges, especially not only technological, but business, economic, political, legal, social, et cetera, in implementing a real-world on-orbit servicing capability. If that's of interest to you and you're not already aware of it, I can send Harley a link or you, whatever.
Yeah, that'd be fine. Actually, one of my employees is a faculty member of ISU, and he has kept me up to speed as you guys have done those scenarios throughout the year. So I am aware of them, but I don't know that I could lay my hands on the charts right now. But thank you for bringing that up. That's good. I'm glad that there are, I mean, servicing encompasses so many orbits, so many types of missions, so many technologies that, you know, the more people working on it, the better, as far as I'm concerned.
Along those lines, Ben, this is Rand Sinberg. What's your relationship with CONFERS?
I am the NASA alternate representative on CONFERS. So for those of you that don't know, CONFERS stands for Consortium for On-Orbit Servicing. I forget the last couple of words in the acronym. So it is a government, today it's government-sponsored consortium to bring government experience for safe on-orbit servicing or safe on-orbit rendezvous take that experience and present it in a forum to industry that wishes to perform commercial servicing on orbit. So today it is DARPA, NASA-led. The NASA lead on it is Trudy Cortez out of NASA headquarters, and I am her alternate. I help write the charter and have been involved with all the meetings ever since. So we will be developing a rules of the road, standard practices, guidelines for a safe rendezvous. And we will be making it available to industry representative, industry members. Eventually, the consortium will be industry-led. We do not want this to be a government affair. We want it to be industry working with itself to maintain a high level of safe standards. And the reason why this is so important, I'm so glad you brought it up, is because if anyone mucks up with a collision in space and creates debris, it's bad for everybody. Whether it's commercial on commercial, government on commercial, government to government, no matter who has the accident, the debris then becomes a problem for all spacefaring entities, public, private, and everything in between. And so CONFERS is an attempt to get some of the knowledge and best practices that NASA and DARPA have developed over the years into industry's hands. Next question.
Ben, this is Dan Lester. I don't want to keep you too long, but, you know, your Restore L is really marvelous. It's really going to be groundbreaking. I was wondering about the details of the telerobotic capability that you actually have there. You have a 7 degree of freedom arm. In fact, it looks like you got two of them. What's on the end of the arm? You have fingers or dedicated wrenches or just a CSV that you plug in? How does it work?
Super question. So the arm has a tool drive, a tool changeout mechanism at the end, and what we call it is the Advanced Tool Drive System, or ATDS. And we will be carrying, let's see if my memory serves me, three separate tools that either robotic arm can pick up. The tools will be held in tool stowage bays on our payload deck. One of the tools we call Ratchet, and as the name implies, it's like a ratchet wrench. It will have multiple adapters that it can pick up. So sometimes it's not worth it to carry a full-blown tool for a small interface. And so we are carrying three tools and I think like five or six adapters that will all be used to do the steps that I mentioned very briefly, cutting through blankets, holding blankets back, cutting wire, removing different size caps, and then refueling. So the arms will go through a series of tool usage and put away, then use this tool, put it away, and then go back to the first tool and then put that one away. So that is another technology suite that we are developing. It is a direct descendant from our EVA tools that we developed for the Hubble missions, where we developed over 300 unique tools for the Hubble servicing missions. So our robotic tool work is a direct offshoot of that. Anyway, so that's the architecture that we've developed for this next mission.
Yeah, that's really good. Does your interface provide any kind of haptics or force feedback?
Presently, I will say that our tools are dumb.
Okay.
Tools are dumb. They do not have any sensory. Today I can say that. We might change one before we launch, where our only force feedback or our only sense is a force torque sensor that is at the base, at the robot wrist.
Okay.
So our robotic wrist has our feet, so we know if we're pushing too hard or not. Yes, the next generation is going to be, tools that have strain gauges in them and other things so that you can sense at the fingertip, not at the base of the wrist, when you've made contact. But we are still learning to walk before we run.
That's great. Thank you.
Yep.
This is Julio Lars, Independent. I'd like to follow up on an earlier observation. But let me proceed first with a question. What is the estimated cost, approximately, of Restore-L?
Oh, that is it. We are going through formulation now, so our cost is being evaluated and decided at NASA headquarters. So I respectfully refuse to have my head lopped off for giving an inaccurate number. Next question.
Let me follow up anyway, and that is whether you or anyone else is doing a sort of a cost-benefit analysis of comparing servicing, however done, with simple straight-out replacements. For example, Landsat 7, the replacement, just building another one, has been estimated, I think, if I remember right, around a little less than $400 million. So
no.
A testing mission.
No, that is not the replacement cost of Landsat 7.
What is the replacement cost of Landsat 7?
If my memory serves, it's It's in the $900 million range, if memory serves. You can check. It's in the NASA's budget. So somebody
that's
can look at it.
Landsat 8 is $850-odd million, and Landsat 7 was about $600, the cost, and doing a second one with the standard 60-70% reduction in cost because the development has been done will come to around $400 million. So if you figure in a 75% probability of success for servicing, that means that the servicing mission, in order to be economically viable, will have to cost around $300 million or less, it seems to me.
Whether
in this work there is an assessment of what is the value of the space asset to be servicing for the servicing mission to be economically feasible. So is anybody looking at that? It seems to me, you know, schedule station is obvious. You know, when you spend $100 or $200 billion for the space assets, almost any cost of servicing is worthwhile rather than a replacement. But if you're looking at a $100 million satellite, I would say the opposite is true. You just send another one. So there must be a break point somewhere. Is anybody trying to determine what that number is?
Well, if I were at a commercial company that wants to do servicing, I'd be putting a lot of effort into that, and I can tell you that they are. I'm not at a commercial company. I'm at a civilian space agency whose job it is to develop technologies for NASA's needs for things like humans going to Mars. And as part of that development effort, transfer that technology to commercial industry. So lots of people are doing that. I am not going to speak for them. I think your numbers for Landsat are off, but I don't want to argue that with you here. I said somewhere in the middle of my talk, one would never conceive of servicing a phone sat or a CubeSat, but building a 20-meter telescope and putting a new instrument in that, right, that makes obvious sense. So there's if you think about this in cars, you have the Yugo, you have the fleet car, and you have the Maserati. And you treat them each differently because they have different values. Servicing is no different. So you asked a general question. The general answer is yes, people are looking at that. To go into the nuance and detail of what mission makes sense and what doesn't, it depends on the item you're talking about servicing.
Okay.
Ben, okay. This is Dan Adamo. I have a question regarding expensive assets. Has the low-hanging fruit strategy you mentioned gone to the point where rendezvous decals are being placed on James Webb?
That's a tough one to answer because I don't want to get in front of the James Webb project. Let me put it this way. Webb is being built here at Goddard, at least the top end is, not the bust. That's a tricky question to answer in such a public forum. 20 years ago, when Webb was only 5 years into its development cycle, the technology that exists today weren't around. And that is when they had to bake in servicing or not. Now, simply putting a decal on the back end is incredibly low-hanging fruit, and we have discussed with them in detail what it would take to do that. And I'll leave it at that for now. I want to be respectful of them controlling the message about their own satellite. But they are going to do the right thing. Let's put it that way.
Okay, well, bravo for making the suggestion.
They're in the very next clean room over, so I've had many years to talk to them about it.
Okay, Ben, this is Dave again. I just wanted to get in this question about assuming you have a really good day on your restore mission with Landsat 7, and Landsat 7 has been refueled and repositioned and everything else. 24
yes.
hours later, what are you going to do with your servicer that's up there and still has some fuel left?
Another great question. So we are working on several different fronts to try to get more value out of it. I will tell you this, the baseline program of record is technology development where Landsat 7 happens to be the client. Your point is very well taken that you're going to have a healthy bus, a healthy servicer with two robotic arms ready to flex their muscles. It sure would be nice to give them something else to do. So at the very least, what we are working on now is if anyone is familiar with our robotic refueling packages we have up on Space Station, our demo packages, we populated the outside of our cube that's up there, our 1 meter cube, with task board mounts. So a task board is like a busy board. It's where we mount our experiments so that the Space Station Dextrous Robotic, or Dexter, can pick up our tools and remove screws, cut wire, you know, practice all the things it's going to have to do for restore. So what our present thinking is that we will put similar task board mounts on the side of restore so that we can hang additional task boards there for future work. I don't know what experiments are going to go there, but we would like to make those spaces available. And you learned, esteemed crowd on the phone today, if anyone has an idea of, you know, an experiment that could go there, I'm not saying we're funding anything, but if you want to fund on your nickel an experiment that could be used with our Dextrous Robotics and our tools, you know, it's like almost like I don't want to say national laboratory, but we want to make it available in an open manner like that. And we're exploring other things. Maybe there's another satellite to be serviced. Maybe there's something else to be refueled. Anyway, we're thinking of lots of things. But today, the program of record is fabulous. It's challenging as hell. It will be groundbreaking. And that is to refuel a legacy satellite.
Would you anticipate that the Restore L bus and payload configuration should be able to be usable by somebody at GeoSync without major mods, or do you think major mods would likely be required?
Oh no! What we built for LEO could be dropped into Geo with almost no mods at all. So thermal is slightly different, the comm architecture is slightly different, and then the radiation for the components. And so we are designing, because we are synergistic with the asteroid mission, we are designing all of our avionics to handle 30K rad, which is what you need for interplanetary, even though we're only going to LEO with Restore for just the type of things you're talking about there, Dave.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. Good pitch, Ben. Right, thanks.
How about one last question?
This is Jonathan Goff from Altius Space Machines. I had a question about for RRM-3, you mentioned that you're going to be testing the ability to transfer liquid methane on stations. Yeah, I was wondering, you know, we've been working on the SBIR program on a cryogenic propellant coupler, and I just wanted to know who in your group would be best to talk with, you know, about seeing if there's any synergies with what we're doing and what you're doing for RRM-3.
Oh, sure. Yeah, you could certainly send it to me. The project lead that I have on that is Jill McGuire. But you could certainly send it to me and we could review it. That sounds great.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
Okay, thank you, Ben. Let's wrap it up. Thank you for the excellent questions, Ben. I think we're going to be hearing a great deal more about this. You've spoken, you and your folks have spoken before us in the past, and we will look forward to hearing from you all in the future. So thank you all again. Folks, if I recollect our schedule, there will not be a FISO seminar next Wednesday. There will be one 2 weeks from today, and of course, all of you are on our emailing list to talk to you then again. Ben, thank you, and thank you, everybody, for listening in. Bye-bye.